This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As a law student in Miami, Mavesh Khan, American daughter of Afghan immigrants, wanted to do something to help both her country and her parents' country. So she put her language skills and knowledge of Afghan culture to use as an interpreter for lawyers who represent men held at Guantanamo Bay. After many visits to the prison, Mavesh began to see some detainees as more than numbers. They became her friends, surrogate brothers and fathers, and Guantanamo Bay itself became more than a name in a newspaper story. Gitmo became a place with its own sounds and smells, its own culture and wildlife. She chronicles all this in a new book, My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. If you have questions about what life is like for detainees and for lawyers at Guantanamo Bay, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later, the new smash hit at the movies purports to pit champions of order and anarchy against each other. We'll explore the Dark Knight's nether reaches. But first, as the first war crimes trial gets underway there today, Guantanamo from the inside out. Mavesh Khan joins us now from the studios of Carrie McCall Productions in San Diego, California. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
And we'd like you to introduce us to this place and to these people. And begin, if you would, at the airport in Fort Lauderdale.
Well, I began my experiences at Guantanamo as a law student, and I was studying the federal torture statutes and how these Washington policymakers were debating the legality of these medieval torture techniques, because once upon a time it was Chinese water torture, and today in America it's waterboarding. And I got involved initially as an interpreter. Mm-hmm. But it starts at the base when I eventually did get involved at Fort Lauderdale, going to the military prison. And we go on these puddle jumper planes that seat about 10 people, and there's no restrooms. And it takes 3 hours, though Cuba is about 90 miles from the mainland. And you have to go away around the country, around Cuba, because we avoid Cuban airspace. And it's often filled with dicey experiences, mm-hmm. but that's how the trip began.
I was fascinated that the one flight you thought would be pretty safely secured, your luggage never gets searched. Do you have to take your shoes off to get on this plane?
No, you don't take your shoes off. There's no metal detectors. Nobody searches your bags. And I remember on the first trip to the base, I asked the individuals who were checking us in, you know, why don't they search our bags at least? And his main concern was dirty laundry and not wanting to touch people's belongings. But they generally just weigh passengers. We hop on the luggage scale and seat you according to your weight distribution. So, you know, the plane is level according to the weight of passengers and luggage.
Yeah, always reassuring when they want to rebalance the plane by moving passengers from one side
exactly.
of it to the other. Weather down there can be tricky, too. But nevertheless, I remember you feeling, you wrote that when you got to Guantanamo, you expected some, you know, forbidding kind of a place. Instead, it's an island paradise.
It is a beautiful place. The water is this green-blue color, and you expect to see hotels and this resort sort of island, but instead there are, I mean, the individuals who work at the base are very friendly, but at the same time you see these prison guard towers and detention centers and know that it's not the paradise that it looks like.
And one thing I did not understand, despite everything I'd read about this place, that the place where the lawyers stay, they're called habeas lawyers as a group, and you're one of their aides as an interpreter, it's separated by water from the area where the prison is.
Exactly. The habeas attorneys are kept on the leeward side of the base. It's about 2.5 miles from the windward side. And on the windward side are the detention centers where the detainees are kept, in addition to where journalists are kept. The military keeps lawyers and journalists separate. And perhaps it's fear that we'll speak together and they don't want more, you know, publicity on this from the attorney side. But we're kept completely separate from all of the main operations on Guantanamo Bay.
And I just want to ask, one of the things that was curious to me about it was at night after the work is done, well, there's one sort of restaurant, if you will, called the Clipper, but everybody seems to buy, well, you know, various kinds of things at the grocery store, the post exchange. Well, I guess it's a Navy base, not a post exchange. But and there's a big barbecue every night for the lawyers.
That's right. The Clipper Club is this greasy spoon where everything is steak or deep fried, from the pizza to the hot dogs, and it's not the best place to eat. So a lot of the attorneys end up going to where a lot of the soldiers and people stationed on the base shop, the NEX, and we buy steaks and have a cookout every night following our meetings with the detainees.
And how long at one stretch might you or any of the other aides or lawyers be there?
It could go anywhere from one day to 5, 6, 10.
So for a while, this feels like your regular routine.
Exactly, yes.
It's very strange. Also, the color of the uniform being worn by the detainees can instantly tell you what category they are.
Right. White often signifies that they're being held in Camp 4, which is a communal setting, and they're kept together. It's designated for compliant detainees, and tan or orange is supposed to signify that they are, you know, not as compliant and cooperative with guards.
So the guards would instantly be able to tell somebody who might be more of a troublemaker than somebody else. But I was fascinated the number of broken toes you report among the compliant detainees. Of course, they have access to athletic equipment, including soccer balls.
Some of the prisoners in Camp 4 do play soccer often. I mean, it varies. Sometimes it's with themselves kicking your soccer ball against a cage, and other times it's with each other. But they would often come to the meeting rooms with these broken toes because they play soccer in flip-flops, and it led to some dicey situations in terms of contact athletics, but they are given soccer balls in Camp 4.
And the prisoners are rotated around, and that there are social strata among the prisoners that you write, the Arabs being held there, regard themselves as different and somewhat better than the Afghans.
Well, one of the Afghan prisoners expressed that he was at one point held in a block of a camp. The camps are categorized in different blocks, but he was held in a predominantly Arab block and felt some level of discrimination. That's not to speak for all of the Arabs, but this was one individual's experience, and he experienced that, yes.
Also, that there is a Gitmo library for some of the detainees?
Well, one of the prisoners described the library as a military guard coming around with either a cart or a box of books, and the detainees are allowed to pick books from that selection. It's often the same books over and over because the habeas attorneys have had difficulty, introducing even Cinderella or Puss in Boots, classic American fairy tales in Arabic or Pashto. And so they often read the same things over and over and get tired of the books. But some of the Afghan prisoners expressed to me that they were tired of reading Harry Potter in Pashto, to the point where some of them began to memorize Harry Potter in Pashto because it gave them something to do. Which sounds like an incredibly boring task.
Indeed. But the one book, of course, they are allowed access to is the Quran.
That's correct. All of the prisoners who would like have access to the Quran, and ideally it's not tampered with and it's in their cells when they would like it.
You note the difficulties that the prisoner in are this legal limbo, and there's various sorts of hearings that you also describe in the book, which are varying. Well, you can make your own judgments about them. Nevertheless, you do draw the conclusion that the reason the detainees were put on Guantanamo Bay was the belief at that time in the Bush administration that this put them beyond the reach of federal courts. The Supreme Court just decided otherwise, but nevertheless, the prisoners were there because they had no rights under federal law, yet the wildlife had rights under federal law.
That's correct. The prisoners at Guantanamo Bay are held outside of U.S. jurisdiction in Cuba, where they are hidden from the press and from the courts and denied the same basic rights that even any alleged rapist or murderer in America has. But at the same time, the iguanas that roam the base are considered, you know, protected by the Endangered Species Act, which is a U.S. federal law, and they receive more protections under U.S. law than the prisoners. And that often outrages the detainees, because anybody who harms or, you know, accidentally runs over anything, any harm done to an iguana, the individual, whether it's a civilian or a military officer, will be prosecuted and fined up to $10,000.
There were some also orange crabs at various times of the year that you weren't so popular.
No, when it rained, these just thousands of these crabs would come out and storm the combined bachelor's quarters, and that's where a lot of the attorneys stay. And they would try to get under the doors, and it would just make a very uncomfortable environment.
I saw that picture. It was on the bottom part of the drive-in, the attack of the giant crabs.
Yes.
We're talking with Mavesh Khan, who's a lawyer and the author of the book My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. If you've ever wondered what life is like at this strange American prison facility on the tip of Cuba for the detainees or for those who work with them, the lawyers and the interpreters, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And Mavesh Khan, I was, again, fascinated that some of the prisoners regarded their lawyers as, well, a little better than grocery clerks.
Clerks. Right. Well, a lot of the attorneys, some of them anyway, feel as though their efforts in federal court are sometimes futile, and the detainees don't always believe that attorneys are able to influence their release. And so they often, you know, come out of their meetings with these long grocery lists of things to bring them, whether it's Klondike bars and Pizza Hut pizza to bring me traditional Afghan food. And, you know, they make a list of things that they want, some of the ones that aren't as bashful as others. But it varies between prisoner. But yes, social worker and waiter is sometimes how some of the attorneys have expressed that they've felt.
We'll talk more with Mavesh Khan in just a moment. Her book, again, is titled My Guantanamo Bay, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Mavesh Khan has traveled to more than 30 times to Guantanamo Bay to work as an interpreter with a lawyer who represents a number of detainees, a new lawyer herself. She now represents one of them as well. You can read about the first time she met a detainee in Guantanamo in an excerpt from her book, My Guantanamo Diary, at our website, npr.org. And if you have questions about what life is like for detainees and lawyers at Guantanamo Bay, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's get Kristen on the line. Kristen with us from St. Louis in Missouri.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Mavesh. Nice to talk to both of you. I just have a quick question about the detainees' feelings towards the Bush administration and also towards the American people. Do they generalize us as, you know, the guards there? You know, some are possibly more, aggressive than others. And how do they view people, you know, just normal Americans and the Bush administration?
Well, my experience has been that the opinions of the prisoners of Americans at large, it varies a lot. Some of them feel that the guards shouldn't be generalized because there are guards who treat them very humanely and there are other individuals in the military who don't. And some of the prisoners, especially after I've met them in Afghanistan, after they've been released, have never expressed anger towards Americans as individuals and have wanted, in fact, to come to the United States, whether it was for medical treatment or, you know, for other reasons. But they, a lot of them from my personal experience, didn't lump everybody in the same category of abuse and misfortune. And they understood that they were being hidden in Guantanamo Bay and that the public was not aware of who they were and, you know, what they were being held for, because that was largely unknown even to them themselves.
Thanks, Kristen.
Thank you very much. I can't wait to read the book. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's get Rich on the line. Rich is calling us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Okay, very well. Thank you.
I don't understand the sympathy for prisoners of war. It doesn't make sense to me why there's so much sympathy for these people who are terrorists and they are prisoners of war. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, the fundamental flaw is to assume that they are all terrorists. And that was the assumption that I made when I went to Guantanamo initially on my first trip to the base 2 years ago. I was scared that I was going to meet somebody who was Taliban or a member of Al-Qaeda who wouldn't want to sit down next to me because I'm a woman and wouldn't want to look at me. And the first individual that I met was a pediatrician who worked for the United Nations to support the American-led democracy in Afghanistan. And the second was, you know, a paraplegic who couldn't walk and couldn't see very well because he had cataracts. And he was brought to Guantanamo on a stretcher, and it was claimed that he was fighting on a battlefield. And I made the same assumptions that you did, that these were terrorists and they must have done something wrong. And a lot of them were sold for bounties given by the U.S. military. And all of those things are unknown to the U.S. and to the world at large about who's out there. And the general assumption is that they must have done something wrong. And certainly some of them have, but without a trial and without process, it's hard to separate.
But they're not U.S. citizens.
Well,
why do they deserve a trial? They're not U.S. citizens.
But
why do they deserve the same rights as an American citizen when they're not an American citizen?
Even in Gulf War I and the initial Vietnam War, we had Geneva Convention Article 5 hearings where we were able to designate and give them hearings and, you know, distinguish whether they were, in fact, fighting on a battlefield or not. And we didn't have that in Afghanistan. A lot of these men were swept up because locals had this huge incentive to gain by, you know, the U.S. military airdropped leaflets offering up to $25,000 per head and never investigated following. And whether they're U.S. citizens or not, when you don't have a system of process and you're just believing what locals are saying and gaining this huge amount of money, it leads to a lot of mistakes happening. And that's what happened at Guantanamo. And, you know, if they are terrorists, give them a public trial, because that's what we did in the first World Trade Center bombings. We have systems of trying terrorists on U.S. soil and then lock them up if we can prove that they've done something wrong. But in the current system, we've not only damaged our reputation all around the world, but, you know, imprisoned good people who haven't done anything wrong. And I'm not speaking broadly about everybody at Guantanamo, because certainly there are the Khalid Sheikh Mohammeds and 9/11 masterminds. But Guantanamo at inception had 800 people, and the U.S. military has released a vast majority of them. And we have 200 and about 50 left. And when you don't have trials and due process, not only are you potentially letting bad guys go and keeping good ones in, but it breaks down what our country was principled and founded upon and what we're celebrated for.
I don't think they should be sympathized, though, like what they're being portrayed. I mean, you went down there and you spoke with these people. You could go to an American prison and speak to the people there, and you're going to get the same kind of comment and reaction as what you got from down there.
I completely agree with you. However,
how horrible the conditions are and how poorly they're treated. And yeah, it sucks to be stuck in an 8x10 cell and wham, wham, wham. I'm sorry, I don't feel any sympathy for these people down there. I don't think they should have any sympathy. They're terrorists.
All of them are terrorists, Rich? Even the 500 the United States decided to let go?
Okay, maybe those aren't. No.
That would be the majority.
Down there, I just, I don't feel that they that the sympathy that
the
is being
basis,
given towards them.
Rich, right?
Let me follow up your point, Rich, if you'll forgive me just a minute and talk with Mavesha Khan about one of the prisoners that she got to know pretty well, a man named Taj Mohammed, a man with an extraordinary command of the English language, a man who said to you that he was a simple goat herd.
That's correct. Taj Mohammed spoke about being a simple goat herder. He developed this great command of English while he was at Guantanamo Bay. And there was never any evidence to suggest that he was anything to do with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. His cousin worked with the U.S. military to set up these water lines in his village of Kunar, Afghanistan. And his family didn't get water and in their house, and that created a feud between the two of them, and they got into a physical altercation. And because his cousin had access to the U.S. military and was working with individuals, he publicly, he told Taj, I'm going to have you turned in and you're going to end up at Guantanamo, and didn't believe it, but that's what ended up happening. And it was brought up even in his military transcripts, where the presiding officer stated, Taj, you should stay away from your cousin Ismail because he got you into this mess. And Taj was released. And there's mistake after mistake of basic, really, fundamental flaws based on a complete lack of investigation on the part of the U.S. military. And
you also wrote that you did not buy into this goat herd story.
Right. Personally, he spoke fluently in English and his command of English was so great that I didn't personally believe that he was a goat herd. And there were individuals who sometimes I didn't believe their stories and were entirely truthful. But that said, he was never accused of being Al-Qaeda or Taliban. He was never charged. And
he was accused of firing rocket-propelled grenades at a U.S. military base in Kunar in exchange for a pair of tennis shoes, you wrote.
These were allegations made by the U.S. military without anything substantiated. And this man was never charged with anything. He was released without being charged with anything. And it goes on and on from detainee to detainee like that. And often the allegations that the U.S. military makes are outrageous and have been dropped subsequently. There was one individual who allegedly worked in, Kashmir to support the separatist movement between India and Pakistan. And yet it was a complete case of mistaken identity because the Abdullah Mujahid, who in fact was involved in those activities, had died while the Abdullah Mujahid, who was an Afghan detainee at Guantanamo, was still imprisoned there. And the military subsequently dropped that allegation, as they do with so many others.
Advocacy situations where you can go to trial and challenge these things, these mistakes can be perpetuated for years, which is exactly your point about Taj. He might have been a smuggler. Who knows? He might have been Taliban. The fact is, there's no evidence against him. If it's not tried out in court, you'll never know.
That's precisely the point of the book. And when you don't have trials and process, that it leads to those sorts of mistakes.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. Let's go to Abadus, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, and calling from Saudi Arabia.
Yes, this is Abdus Samad. First, I would like to say good evening and assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
I just want to know, what are the medical facilities available to the personnel and the detainees and even the lawyers who are visiting? I'll take the answer offline.
And thanks very much for the phone call.
Regarding the medical facilities, my understanding is that the prisoners request medical attention. There was one individual who was 80 years old, Haji Nusrat. He was a paraplegic and he was constantly in pain of his various ailments. And whether it was his eyes, he was given an incorrect prescription, so it didn't really make a difference. And I suppose it varies a lot. I can't speak consistently of all prisoners who've been seen by a doctor. In terms of attorneys, there haven't been any attorneys that I've worked with who have sought out medical care from the facilities. But,
Okay, let's see if we can get Carol with us. Carol's on the line from San Mateo in California.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling from the perspective of a fellow interpreter. I'm an interpreter in Superior Court in the state of California. And I'm at the beginning stages of writing a book about some of my interpreting experiences. However, my concern is that the conversations that I interpret are largely protected under attorney-client privilege. And I'm wondering, how did you get past that privilege when you were publishing a book about that? Did you have to get permission from each attorney, each client? How did you handle that logistical part of your book?
Great question. First of all, I began as an interpreter, and I do represent one client now under supervision by a corporate law firm that I work with. However, all conversations that take place within Guantanamo are protected by the attorney-client privilege, as well as the information that I get from individual prisoners is deemed classified. The detainee leaves Guantanamo Bay, it's another issue, and they control the attorney-client privilege. However, most of the attorneys that I worked with were incredibly supportive and helped me get my notes declassified. Everything that I submitted for my book was presented to the Department of Defense, and anything that was returned unclassified largely was published. There were some bits of information that were considered classified and they were never published, but it went through this back and forth process. And I worked with a large number of attorneys who were very supportive of publicly getting the voices of these men to the American public, because the American public does not know these men as individuals.
Carol, good luck with your book.
Okay, thank you very much.
We're talking with Mavesh Khan, a lawyer and the author of the new book, My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get Chris on the line. Chris with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Yes, Neil, thank you for taking my call. I have a two-pronged question. I'll get to them very quickly. I was wondering about the time periods involved with the detainees, just exactly who's been there the longest and the average length of stay. And one other presumptive question that she might be able to answer would be exactly what kind of a situation would she find working with either perhaps a McCain or an Obama administration, and what she might consider to be friendlier, more friendly to the detainees', shall we call it, plight. And I'll take my answer off the line, and thank you very much, Neil.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Go ahead.
Regarding the second question, I believe both presidential candidates have stated that they are in favor of closing the base. And I do believe that, the Obama campaign has expressed that they would like to see the base close, whereas the McCain campaign has said similar, has expressed similar sentiments, however, has also, called them the worst of the worst. Mm-hmm. And it's unknown largely who these men are without a trial, and that's the fundamental aspect of the book. And please excuse me, but I can't remember the first segment of the question.
How long are people typically held at Guantanamo?
On average,
who's been the longest? Yeah.
I've seen individuals. Dr. Ali Shah, the pediatrician, he was the first individual I ever met there. He was imprisoned at Guantanamo for a little over 3 years before he was released without ever having been charged. And then there's also individuals like Sami Al-Haj, who Al Jazeera journalist, who was also never charged but released approximately 7 years afterwards. And there are hundreds of prisoners who are still being held there going on 7-8 years.
Are they getting fresh prisoners at Guantanamo Bay after that importation of the 12 of the 15 high profile cases?
Well, the high-value detainees were largely brought in on Guantanamo's fifth anniversary, paraded before the press, and America learned that, hey, we do have bad guys here. But other than those 15 high-value detainees who were brought on the fifth anniversary, the military base does not see new imports. That stopped in 2004 after the first Supreme Court decision allowing lawyers to come to Guantanamo. And Guantanamo is really the face of a much larger Oregon, a problem. You know, there's CIA detention centers and prisons all across the world, in Europe and Afghanistan and Africa. Bagram Air Base north of Kabul holds approximately, it's speculated, about 1,000 prisoners. And a lot of prisoners never make it to Guantanamo following the attorney's involvement at the base.
And hard to believe that many of your detainees describe Guantanamo as much better than Bagram Air Base. But
Well, absolutely. Bagram is located far from the public eye and
far from lawyers and far from the United States, too. So
absolutely. And that's where a predominant amount of torture and abuse has been described.
Mahvesh Khan, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Mahvesh Khan's new book, My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. Coming up, forget Batman. The Joker was the big draw at the movies this weekend. What is it that's so appealing about this character with green hair and white face? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This weekend, hundreds of thousands of people flocked to the movies to see the latest Batman epic, The Dark Knight. All told, they spent more than $150 million domestically on tickets, and that is a record, the biggest three-day take in history. In the movie, Batman, played by Christian Bale, battles the Joker, played by Heath Ledger, the Australian actor who died just a few months ago of a drug overdose. Critics heap praise on his performance as the green-haired, white-faced villain who steals every scene he's in. But whether it's Cesar Romero from the old TV show or Jack Nicholson from another movie several years back, Washington Post writer Hank Stuver notes that the Joker seems to be more interesting than the Dark Knight himself. Writers and artists and filmmakers and actors, Stuver writes, adore the Joker because the narrative dynamic is so arresting as a pure visual. The guy in the black pleather getup who lurks around parapets at night is the good one, and the clown is the bad one. So what, if anything, do you find appealing about the Joker in general, this Joker in particular? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Hank Stuver of The Washington Post is with us here in Studio 3. Nice to have you with us on the program today.
Good afternoon.
And you also take us through a history of the Joker and find that it does not originate with the Batman saga.
No, I guess it doesn't. Comic book lore has Bob Kane and the people he was working with in 1940 on an early Batman adventure. They wanted to have a killer on the loose in Gotham, and their inspiration when they started to draw him, they wanted a scary clown, which was kind of vanguard back then. Clowns weren't scary. There's all sorts of scary clowns now, and people are really afraid of clowns, and they'll sit on a couch and tell you about it for hours, about how afraid they are of everyday clowns. But they picked, they were fascinated by a movie, a silent movie from 1928 called The Man Who Laughs, starring an actor named Conrad Veidt.
And you will have seen him as a Nazi in 1,000 movies.
Right. In this one, he plays an unfortunate sort of Phantom of the Opera type who is hideous and hides from people because he has a smile permanently plastered on his face. And to see pictures of him, it's actually quite scary. Mm-hmm. You can go online and just Google him and get pictures of the Man Who Laughs. And when you look at the first Joker adventure in the old Batman comics, he looks exactly like Conrad Veidt. And he was disturbing, and they really thought he was too disturbing and they'd kill him off. And as legend has it, they redrew the last panel of that issue to show him possibly escaping so that maybe the Joker would return. He has been returning for 68 years, and it's evolved into this really psychotic relationship that Batman and the Joker have.
You note that he's been killed off a few times, but then again, so has Batman. So
everyone in comic books has been killed off. I always tell people, don't get too drawn in by the hype of so-and-so is dying, Captain America is dying, Superman is dead, and all the villains. They always come back.
The character, though, that original character was terrifying because his purpose was not to pull a bank job, not to pull a heist. His purpose was anarchy. His purpose was terror.
Right. you know, every permutation of Batman is full of villain soliloquies in which they sort of describe their grand scheme, the thing they're working toward. And Joker just has pretty much always said, you know, he does like to rob banks, and he robs a bank quite spectacularly at the beginning of this new Batman movie. But he has always just preferred to state his case as pure and simple anarchy.
And you also note that in the sequence of creators of Batman, that we've got to the point where Frank Miller, who's the author of this this particular scenario, I guess, really has come to understand the relationship between the Joker and the Batman, in that they're both wacko.
Right, right. Like, to understand the relationship most completely. And when Batman and Joker have had some conversations in graphic novels about their codependence, they both acknowledge that the relationship is messed up.
And they're both freaks.
They're both freaks, yes. Yeah, yeah. Batman is a vigilante freak. Joker is far more appropriate to our times, I think, just by simply by being an evildoer, a terrorist.
Let's see if we get some callers in on this conversation.
Absolutely.
What fascinates you about the Joker? Or not, maybe. Anyway.
Well, what fascinates me about the Joker, real quickly, is that, you know, I grew up watching Batman reruns from the TV show, and it was like, ha, 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 Batman, hoo, 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 Batman. And it was just sort of this goony Carnaby Street clown. And then, you know, over time, in my lifetime, as I grew up and continued to keep an eye on what was going on in comic books, it seemed like our world needed him to get more and more scary, more and more psychotic, until you get to this movie in which he's unbelievably psychotic, and the character is reduced and whittled down to just being terrifying in a way that Cesar Romero never would have dreamed of.
And Jack Nicholson didn't get to. I mean,
no,
Jack Nicholson
treated it as a lark.
Where did he get those marvelous toys? I mean, it was anyway, yeah. Let's get some callers in. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We're talking with Hank Stuever of the Washington Post. Let's start with Chris. Chris with us from Athens, Ohio.
Yes, hi.
Go ahead, please.
So you're talking about the Joker, and the reason I really like the Joker is that he's just a character that it changes over time, and so different writers can use him in such a way that they can just drape new ideas over the character. I guess Hank is the gentleman's name.
Yes.
Was saying the characters change quite a bit. One thing that I'd recommend reading is Arkham Asylum by the writer Grant Morrison, and he puts forth the idea that the Joker is just more evolved than other people. He is more mentally capable of dealing with the sort of chaos that is being created in modern society. And so he's actually just ahead of us.
Arkham Asylum, by the way, is located in Gotham, and it's where the arch-villains are kept under the care of the Scarecrow, also an arch-villain. But go ahead.
Right, right. Arkham Asylum is a great gothic mental hospital on the edge of town. The Arkham Asylum graphic novel was really, it came out in the late 80s, and it really was terrifying. It was one of those comic books that really didn't want to sleep in the same room with. It was painted. It wasn't drawn in a traditional comic book fashion, and the Joker in it is really terrifying. And it was all leading, I think, to this point, to when you put the Joker on a big screen now, he really has to be, this is a world that has seen Hannibal Lecter, and any number of serial killers every night on CSI. It just takes more to take us to that horrible place.
Chris, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
Let's see if we could go now to Zach. And Zach with us from Provo, Utah.
Hi.
Hi.
The reason I think this Joker, especially in this film, and Heath Ledger's performance is so interesting, is because I think he embodies this sort of recognition that the philosophers, I think, have grappled with for a long time, that what do you define morality and goodness as, you know, and is it just a socially constructed thing that falls apart once society falls apart? You know, I think he embodies, especially now with terrorism and then our government trying to be good but doing all these things that we see as wrong, you know, there's a lot of questions about, well, what's moral, what's good, what's the cost, and I think he embodies that sense of, you know, he's not interested in winning either. He doesn't care. He doesn't want to win. He just wants to disrupt. Mm-hmm.
And observe. He likes to watch.
He likes to see what people do when they're pressed to the limits. And one terrific thing about this film, without spoiling it, is there's a wonderful scene where everybody has to Joker wants to put everybody in a situation where they have to make a terrible decision.
Zach, your terrible decision was apparently to call us.
I just think there's a Norse myth character called the Fenris Wolf that just sort of, it's like entropy. It just eats everything and destroys everything. And this character reminds me of that. It actually also reminds me of Cormac McCarthy's writing in No Country for Old Men.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same as Anton Chigurh. It's how humans trying to exist in the world and trying to be good and survive deal with chaos.
I see that part, but those were sort of elemental characters. And the Joker is, he's not so much elemental as carried away with himself and with his strange mission in life.
Well, and his strangeness. And one thing that everyone who's done either a graphic novel or a movie about the Joker in the last 20 years has picked up on is the Joker loves the media. And he is a media creation. And, one thing I like about this new Batman movie is that they sort of dispense with the origin story of the Joker, which always involved him falling in a vat of chemicals and being permanently altered. This guy just wears makeup, and that's almost more twisted than having a reason why you're white, you are white and your hair is green and your smile is plastered on your face.
It's not a revenge.
He's just, he's just messed up. And he craves media attention at the same time, which just makes him perfect.
Perfect for an actor, too. Anyway, Zach, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Doug. Doug's calling us from Dayton in Ohio.
Hi, how you guys doing?
All right.
Great.
Great. I wanted to talk real quick about Alan Moore's The Killing Joke, which I think is my favorite portrayal of the Joker. If for no other reason than even though the Joker admits that the backstory presented in that comic may or may not be true, it presents us with sort of a simultaneously sympathetic and extremely terrifying character. And that is very rarely done with the Joker, mm-hmm. I think.
I love The Killing Joke, too. And in my piece in The Post, which ran a week ago, I opened with the scene where Batman thinks he's talking to the Joker and says, where's this all going? What is it between you and me? I think we're going to kill each other one day, and I'm here to try to avoid that. And the funny part about that is that he discovers that it's a Joker imposter in the cell and that the Joker is actually out in the world. The Killing Joke is great because the Joker winds up, getting the you-know-what kicked out of him by Batman, and he seems to love that. There's this whole sadomasochistic element to Batman and the Joker, and hit the Joker, he loves it. He loves being beat up by Batman.
And Batman loves to do it.
Oh, of course.
Doug, thanks very much for the call. Alan Moore, by the way, the author of, among many other things, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and many other wonderful comics. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let me reintroduce our guest is Hank Stuever. He's a staff writer at The Washington Post. We're talking about his piece, The Joker's On to Us. What does it all mean when Batman's enemy is more interesting than the Dark Knight himself? And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Erica with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that this Joker in particular was my favorite because he truly, truly represented the wild card. Every time someone thought they had the better hand or the upper hand and it was all over, he would just blow them away
I agree. The movies, where the Joker is concerned, and let me give the caveat, the magic fairy has not come down from the sky and anointed me ever a film critic, but I did see the movie a couple of weeks in advance, and I came away kind of worried about the movie's plot, but totally over the top in love with Heath Ledger's performance as this Joker, and also the way that Joker is written gets to everything you're talking about.
Definitely. He will be missed, and it's sad to say that he won't be coming back as the Joker regardless of what the plot had in mind for him.
Yep.
Erica, let me ask you, and Hank as well, since we know that Heath Ledger is not coming back to play anybody, does that not add a certain resonance to his performance as the Joker?
Oh, I think so. I think it's a Jim Morrison kind of quality that, you sell more of records or tickets or whatever because people are drawn into, in a very macabre way, but also in a very respectful way, this idea that a creepy thing is made more unsettling by the end of Heath Ledger.
And, Erica, how did it play into your, as you watched the movie?
Well, I'm a big fan of Heath Ledger's movies, and this was definitely a defining moment in his career. It was a different character from anything he's ever done before. So he will be missed.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
appreciate the phone call. Let's see if we can go now to, this is Tony. Tony's with us from Anchorage in Alaska.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. First of all, I want to say I absolutely love this film. I've seen it 3 times since it came out.
Wow.
So I've gone once a day.
Now, you haven't done much else.
No, I wanted to bring up 2 kind of antithetical points between Batman and the Joker. The first being that they are both free for very different reasons. Bruce Wayne is free because he has everything. He's a multi-billionaire, and he has the resources to take off as much time as he wants, and he can have any equipment he needs, etc. The Joker is free because he has nothing, and he has absolutely nothing to lose. There's no loved ones. He has no house, no property. What are you going to take from him? There's a wonderful scene in the film where Batman is trying to interrogate the Joker, and the Joker would love for Batman to just kill him because that would prove that Batman was not infallible. So I really like that antithesis. And the other was between Batman and Joker. Again, Batman lives his life, especially in this most recent series of Batman movies we've seen, according to a very strict moral code and rules and ethics and the way things should be done. And Joker, by comparison, has absolutely no rules and will break a rule simply for the sake of demonstrating that it doesn't really exist. So I think those two elements really help to give the Batman and Joker a really dynamic field of play.
I would only quibble with one thing, Tony, and that's the Joker having nothing to lose. He is so often in all of these stories, going back to the Bob Kane days, so frustrated when he is captured and held, usually in Arkham Asylum, and that is intolerable to him, and that is what he is at risk. That's what he puts at risk.
Yeah. I agree that what's alluring in this movie is that the Joker has a lot less to lose, and that's again by getting rid of so much. This new Batman series gets rid of so much of the falderal that got us to this point. I mean, you know, the Joker used to show up in green and purple helicopters, and I mean, so he obviously had a job or
some
resources. Yeah.
An ATM card. Yeah. Tony, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And what does it say, finally, Hank Stuver, about this franchise, which has died and been revived any number of times, and in its darkest, I think it's fair to say, maybe except for that cartoon version, that darkest version yet seems to be doing so extraordinarily well.
The consumer has spoken, and you know, you think that there's not a whole lot of people out there thinking about what the next Batman movie should be from a consumer perspective. But if you look at the fact that 150,000 people are going to Comic-Con this week, there are a lot of people out there thinking about Batman movies. And the darker they get, the better. That's how the readers like him. That's how the readers like this whole story. And obviously, they keep adding to it.
Hank Stuver, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Hank Stuver, a staff writer for The Washington Post, and we were talking about, well, what else is everybody talking about? The Joker and Batman. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.